You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the servants, California and beyond.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The United States has launched new airstrikes against Iran, and Tehran responded by targeting Gulf countries. The exchange of fire threatened an interim deal intended to help end the war in the Middle East. Back-and-forth attacks have repeatedly threatened the ceasefire. President Trump spoke at a news conference.
I don't think it's going to start again. I think it's going to go very quickly. They hit a couple of ships, and so we hit them much harder. When they hit, we hit 10 times harder. You know, we hit much harder than they do. We have a lot better equipment than they do. We may even, somebody asked before, do you think you'll hit them tonight? I said, we might. Yeah, we might.
Sirens sounded at least three times in Bahrain. Missiles targeted Kuwait and Qatar. The strikes came hours after Trump said that recent Iranian attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz signaled the end of a fragile ceasefire and threatened to escalate the conflict if they didn't stop. That raised concerns that the region could tip back into a war. Ukrainian drones hit more Russian oil facilities and set two oil tankers ablaze in the Sea of Azov. The strikes come a day after President Trump pledged to grant Ukraine a license to manufacture the Patriot air defense systems. Ukraine's strikes on oil refineries and other infrastructure across Russia have triggered a fuel crisis, with gasoline shortages and fuel rationing in multiple regions. A top Ukrainian official, meanwhile, cautioned that it could take a year or more for the country to produce Patriot interceptor missiles. Kremlin played down the license deal and noted it appreciated President Trump's efforts to help broker a peace deal and to end the war, which Russia launched over 4 years ago with a full-scale invasion of its neighbor. Ukraine's allies will meet in Paris on Monday to discuss ongoing support for Kyiv after President Volodymyr Zelensky attended the NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey this week, where he won renewed pledges of support in his country's war with Russia. President Trump threw the summit into disarray with insults and threats directed at allies and more calls for a U.S. annexation of Greenland. Stuart Smith reports.
There was trepidation amongst NATO leaders as Donald Trump started Wednesday's summit with criticism of NATO allies, notably Denmark, suggesting that the US was still interested in annexing Greenland, and also for Spain, which is the only NATO ally of the 32 that has not promised to increase its GDP spent, its proportion of GDP spent on defence to 5%. It's staying around 2%. So Donald Trump suggested that he would try to cut trade ties with Spain and that there would be political repercussions.
Democratic Maine Senate candidate Graham Platner has announced he's dropping his bid for incumbent Republican Senator Susan Collins' seat amid more allegations of sexual misconduct. Democrats are scrambling to find another nominee. More from Nathan Elgren.
Platner has denied the allegations against him. His exit from the race will likely force a reckoning within the Democratic Party, which has been divided between its moderate and progressive factions as it struggles to unify during this year's midterm elections. Maine is considered a key state for control of the narrowly divided Senate, and Democrats were desperate for a candidate capable of defeating Republican Senator Susan Collins, while President Donald Trump is broadly unpopular. Plattner, a military veteran and oyster farmer, consolidated support from primary voters who were eager for a more combative candidate who focused on economic inequality. Progressive Democratic leaders like Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Ruben Gallego, and Congressman Ro Khanna supported Plattner, but pulled their endorsements after a report surfaced that he had drunkenly forced a woman he was dating to have sex after she told him to stop. Maine state law includes a provision for Democrats to replace Plattner and name a new candidate before the end of July.
That's Nathan Elgren. The number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits dipped slightly last week, as layoffs in the U.S. remain historically low. The Labor Department said today that U.S. applications for jobless aid in the week ending July 4th ticked down by 2,000 to 215,000. Analysts surveyed by the data firm FactSet forecast 220,000 new applications. Weekly filings for unemployment benefits are considered a proxy for layoffs and are close to a real-time indicator of the health of the U.S. job market. Those are the Pacifica headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk with Abaji's Director of Policy and Advocacy, Ronald Claude, on the Supreme Court's recent decision allowing the revocation of Haitian temporary protective status. And then we speak with Dr. Barbara Ransby about the necessity of Black voting power and the left as we reimagine democracy. All this and more on Sojourner Truth. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. We look at the devastating decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to allow the administration to strip over 350,000 Haitians living in the United States of temporary protective status, commonly known as TPS. Please to discuss this decision, what it means, and next steps with the Haitian American Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Mr. Ronald Claude. Greetings, Ronald.
Hi, Nana. How are you?
Well, I think we both could be better and at the same time.
Yes, 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 absolutely.
Our comrade says alive and kicking, and that's it. And I'm definitely kicking in certain directions, definitely kicking in certain directions. So we have this decision by the United States Supreme Court. They sure know how to make people wait. They know sure know a cliffhanger, waiting till almost the last day to make a decision about whether TPS holders who are Haitian are going to be able to have their TPS extended or whether they were going to allow the Trump administration to revoke TPS, and they chose to allow it. The opinion is 70 pages long. It fell on ideological grounds. So you had six that were, you know, the six conservatives voting to allow the Trump administration's revocation, the three so-called liberals to rule against that, you know, to dissent. Let's talk about the two main reasons that were given. Again, it's a 70-page piece, listener, so it's very long if you want to go through that. But the two main pieces, let's talk about them one by one. So firstly, the plaintiffs, the TPS holders, had said in their lawsuit that the revocation of TPS was unlawful, unconstitutional, because
it was the result of racism. They said that Trump was clearly racist against Haitians. And the majority said, what are you talking about? Nothing to see here. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, this is unfortunately part of the course. And, you know, we talked briefly before this, and I still am questioning, is this really the best of the best that all our law schools can offer? But quite frankly, you know, it is something that they are choosing to do that is, you know, where that serves the cruelty, which is the point, right? And it ignores the fact that it is racist. They went through and reviewed and saw quotes and video of this administration, the current president in the White House saying word for word things like Haitians eat cats and dogs. They have AIDS or HIV and, you know, all these dangerous, violent, racist tropes like he associated with Haitians. And they said that it had nothing to do with race. And this was simply just about, you know, maybe he doesn't like the Haitians, but it's nothing about race. Well, I don't know how you can hear those comments, understand their context, the historical context of it. Like, you know, this is not new things that unfortunately have been associated with Haitians, and to say that it has nothing to do with race. And so on that grounds, the court apparently has ignored it, and they're like, oh no, it's not racist. And maybe at best Trump doesn't like the Haitians, which is that is ridiculous. But again, it's part of this, how this court has moved in the last, you know, this iteration of it, right? I can't even say last few weeks, right? This is what it's been for the last few years.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that's so interesting is that when in Trump, when they first asked to revoke TPS, there was arguments that were made around the racism. And the ways in which this administration or that administration, Trump won, the ways that they had described Haiti, had described African countries. And it was, you know, it was understood. Ninth Circuit said, yeah, that's racist. And it was allowed to hold by this court. This is the thing that's so interesting. It's like, yes, this court is terrible and has been terrible. But in this particular term of the Trump administration, it has just been horrific, right? And so the court then, you know, held it. It was held. TPS was not revoked. We had a whole term of the Biden administration only to come into this administration. And suddenly what was clearly racist before is not racist now. And of course, we could say that with the Calais case in terms of their decision that you cannot resolve race discrimination using race, right? Can't use race to help race, all of that foolishness that's coming out of there. And, you know, as you pointed out, it is par for the course. And so, you know, we can expect that will expand. And when we start finding people leaving nooses on people's desks and making comments about watermelon and fried chicken to Black people, I'm sure this court will also be finding no employment discrimination there, because that's not going to be racist either. Moving now to the second big ground, which was the ground of Haiti is fine. What are you talking about? Or if Haiti is not fine, then it's the best that Black people deserve. A quote that from Stephen Miller shortly after the ruling, he said that Haiti is in the same, you know, as good condition as Chicago or St. Louis. Literally backhand slapping Black people in three different locations at once.
Right.
Is Haiti in a better condition than it was or than it has been during this whole time that Haitians have been under temporary protective status? And why does that matter?
I don't even know where to begin, because I've been a part of work that the whole premise of it has been how important it is that we finally just have our hands off Haiti, in the sense of almost, you know, to put it simply, allowing Haiti to be so free that they're able to make mistakes. And that just has not been the case. And, you know, I joke that I'm old, but not by much. But as long as I can remember, I'm talking about 2004. So before the 2010 earthquake, Haiti has been messed with. Then the Haitian earthquake came. And then it's like, you know, people are taking some of the funding that was supposed to go for the relief. And, you know, then it's like don't get me started on the assassination of the president more recently in 2021 or 2022. It was. And now, you know, all that you remember, I remember so many talks a couple years ago how Haiti has to have, you know, free and fair democratic elections. There's been no elections, but there's been a couple of new prime ministers. I don't know how they got there in a democracy. And so you see all of these and don't even, and then I'd even mention the UN and how, you know, spreading cholera throughout Haiti, or, you know, even the, you know, the Kenyan troops coming to support. So all of this does not give the sense of, yeah, everything's okay. Nothing to see here, y'all. You know, we proceed as planned. That energy and this idea that Haiti's okay and nothing's going on and it's safe and it's normal is just not true, because quite frankly, the people that are, or the folks that I would, you know, consider that are one of the main problems for why, you know, Haiti can't get on track, so to speak, is this administration, this country's, you know, historic policies around it. And quite frankly, so much unnecessary and unneeded, unwanted, you name it, intervention from the international order of things. So now we're at this point and we're seeing all of that. And then it's the here that it's like, well, you know, it's just as bad as, you know, Chicago. It's a slap in the face, like you said, to the Haitians, to the Black folks from those communities. And in general, it's an indication of what they think of us. There's a lawyer that I really look up to, and they shared about how they heard of a case of how there was this Haitian person seeking asylum, and then the judge, you know, essentially not granting the asylum because of the simple fact that, you know, the case was like, I can't go back to Haiti, it's so bad, etc. Like, I won't be safe, right? Now, maybe not so bad, but I won't be safe if I go back. And then them saying that, well, Haiti always is like this. This is what Haiti is. So again, it's this idea of like, this is the best it's ever going to be. This is what these Black folks deserve. And regardless of the roles we played in making it so, you know, this is, we will send them back to, you know, their death or to their, you know, to whatever awaits them, because that's all they deserve. That's what's supposed to happen to them. And it's just sad. It's cruel. And again, it seems like it's ignoring all the laws of international law, human rights, etc., that we're supposed to be abiding by.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy, and we are speaking with Ronald Claude, Director of Policy and Advocacy with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, on the SCOTUS decision revoking temporary protective status for over 350,000 Haitians in the United States.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy.
Thinking about how many people we're talking about. So at some point towards the very end, like right before the court was going to make its decision, Syrian TPS holders were added to the case, because the court will do that sometimes. It'll take similar cases and combine them into one if they feel like our decision here is going to matter, you know, and count. No need to say the same thing twice. Syrians that have TPS, 6,000. Mm-hmm. Haitian TPS holders, over 350,000.
Yeah.
And again, you know, what, you know, you are Haitian American.
Yes.
Have family, obviously, community, et cetera, that are impacted, people in mixed status families with folks that are TPS holders. 350,000. I mean, these are folks that are all embedded in our communities, in our families, in our lives.
Right.
What has this experience been from them? You know, as a person that is in conversation, the conversations that are not just the policy workspace, right? The conversations right. that are not just the organizing power building space, the conversations with the nurses, with the, you know, that's the regular folks, service workers, right? The regular folks who have TPS. What has it been for them over this past year in particular that TPS had been revoked?
Yeah, you know, it's been hard, and it's been like balancing this constant worry, looking over your shoulder, never being able to take that deep breath or that sigh of relief, right? And so that's what they've been living with for the past few years as TPS has been, you know, up and down in terms of its stability, in terms of like, is it going to be continued? Will I be able to work? Will I be able to provide for my family? Will I be able to pick up my kids from school safely, etc., like you're saying? And I think what is even more telling is that the Haitian community, and in any community really, but you know, specifically as the Haitian community is the one I know and I'm a part of, we're a proud people. And the last few weeks, you could see that joy and pride really demonstrate itself after, you know, watching the Haitians celebrate the men's national team making the World Cup. And the Haitians didn't win a game in that World Cup, but there was so much joy, an opportunity to talk about our country in a positive light, to talk about our history, our mentality of never giving up, and how our efforts to be one of the first free Black countries in the Western Hemisphere was spread throughout spread out throughout Latin America. And there was so much pride, folks sharing the history and talking. And for all of that, you know, and to reach a climax or a peak yesterday, when Haiti scored their first goal in the World Cup after 52 years. Right. And so everyone is excited. Everyone's happy and going over the moon. And we lost that game. But, you know, it was just a matter of like, it was great. It was cool to feel Haitian, and everyone from, you know, folks on the island, folks across the diaspora in this country, and even Haitians in Canada or France. We all were collected and unified around that. And then just for it to dissipate in less than 24 hours with this type of decision and cruelty that doesn't see us as human, doesn't see the positive essence we bring or the fabric we are to the communities that we're a part of. And so, yeah, it's been hard. But, you know, I also would say that because we are who we are in terms of never giving up, I think people are still, you know, putting their head down, trying to figure it out. But there's a lot of worry. And there's a lot of like, what happens next? What should I do? And all those questions that I know we will get into a little bit. So I think right now folks are, you know, still looking over their shoulder. Unfortunately, you know, this the energy and excitement that maybe they experienced from the World Cup has dissipated to, how am I going to support the folks I know that this decision is going to impact? And, you know, where do we go from here? And even, you know, and the more astute folks, I'll end here, are also understanding how the arc of this country, the history of this country, was that there was a letdown even before this administration. Looking at, you know, both parties in terms of the roles they played in terms of what could have been done to avoid this situation, right? What were the efforts that, what were the opportunities missed to provide a permanent pathway or permanent protection for these Haitians and other folks on TPS, maybe under a Biden administration? So that's all the types of conversations and feelings that are happening. But nonetheless, I think we're trying to stick together and try to figure out what is the best next steps and what should we be telling our communities and folks that are going to be negatively impacted by this decision.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I am not Haitian, but I have Haitian family, folks that I love. And I'm telling you, I have been just even leading up to today, just feeling sick. You know, like I told someone, I was like, I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. And part of it's just because we know that the fact that Trump is a racist or that this administration is racist is not mean anything to these racist Supreme Court justices. They're like, right, that's our boy. And just knowing that that hammer comes down on people. People are panicked. You know that. I know that. We're hearing from the panicked people who are really worried, who have been holding their breath and now find that, you know, they're still holding. They don't get to do that sigh of relief. And so what can we tell folks? I know it's still early. People are still sort of analyzing, figuring out how quickly this goes into effect, you know, what processes or other processes people may be able to do. But in the meantime, What should our Haitian siblings on TPS be hearing from us, you know, through this conversation, but also from other folks who may be listening to this conversation who also have Haitian family, siblings, loved ones, you know, co-workers, et cetera, that we can share? What should Haitian TPS holders be doing and not doing in this moment?
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, that's a great and important piece. I think it starts off with a simple premise of do not panic. Right. We know we're not surprised by the cruelty. We're not surprised about what Trump is doing. And so we got to remember that in all the things we do and how we move, whether you are impacted directly or, you know, folks that you love and care for are right. And so we do not panic. Right. That's the first thing. Then, you know, if you are unsure or need more information about your specific situation, it's very important that you consult with an immigration attorney and, you know, identify or understand what are potential immigration statuses that you can adjust to. So that's very important. In that same sentence, look out for fraudsters. Unfortunately, in times like this, when people are looking for alternatives or looking for, you know, support and relief, unfortunately, there's people out there that want to take advantage of that. So it's very important that, you know, you really look through. If you have questions, if things don't seem right or they seem too good to be true, definitely, you know, seek a second opinion. That's always important. Do not make any sudden moves on top of that to self-deport or quit your job. We don't even know when this is going to be enacted or how it's going to be enacted. So don't go preemptively like, oh, it's over. I'm going to sell my house, sell my car, and, you know, go to Canada. No, you know, deep breath again, right? And let's see as the news comes out what is going to happen, how it's going to happen, and when it's going to happen. And then finally, looking out for organizations like BAJI, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, that I'm a part of, that will have information and talking points for you to share with folks and have Know Your Rights cards, etc. So, you know, there will be information, and also, you know, other trusted organizations and advocates that are doing this work. Look for them for support. Look for them for information and ask questions, right? They may not always be able to provide potentially like a direct attorney for you, but they definitely can point you in the right direction. So please use that. Do not assume no one is out there to help you. And then in terms of what next, you know, in the spirit of the Haitian revolution, we don't give up. And, you know, I think that it's like, okay, well, this happened. This is the big court, you know, what else can we do? These judges said it, right? But no, there's still some work out there that we can push. And, you know, there's Congress that we can still ask of to do something to intervene. So there, for instance, the Senate brought a companion legislation to what Representative Ayanna Pressley pushed as a discharge petition for Haitian TPS that would provide a 3-year extension for folks on TPS. You know, that passed the House earlier this year, and now there's a Senate bill. So we're asking folks to reach out to your senator. BAJI actually has a letter that we've been sharing publicly that is that folks can use as a base or even use as their own to push for their own language, to push their own senator to, you know, join this marquee bill that would support in the Senate, that would support Haitian TPS extension. Then we also should work to see alternative solutions that are permanent, like HRIFA, which is what we're calling it, which is Haitian Refugee Immigration Fairness Act, which would create a real pathway to permanent protections for Haitian TPS holders, not relying on, you know, another temporary band-aid of sorts. And it's similar to what the Liberian community was able to have as legislation a couple years back. And then finally, citizenship for all. Again, this has to be the fight. We have to stop with the low-hanging fruit of a TPS here, a humanitarian parole here. We got to push as a unified community with some of our other folks in the diaspora, not some of our other folks, our other brothers and sisters in the diaspora, you know, asking for citizenship for all, right? Passing legislation that is going to provide the most people at the same time a pathway to citizenship or permanent protections. And so that's what we need to be pushing for. And that's what we should be calling on Congress. So your senator and your representative, and even your local electeds, because that's the other thing, folks, like, Yes, we want it to pass on a federal, on the federal scale, but you know, a lot of the time these folks are influenced by what they're hearing from their, you know, their local partners or local electeds in their districts and city, in the cities that they're coming from. So being in their ear, all sides' ears, right? It will make our job easier.
Thank you so very much, Ronald. We appreciate you. We're going to be fighting. We are not defeated. We are not defeated. Never. Thank you so very much. We really appreciate you coming on.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That was Mr. Ronald Claude, Director of Policy and Advocacy with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, speaking on the Supreme Court decision revoking Haitian temporary protective status. More Sojourner Truth with our conversation with Dr. Barbara Ramsby after this short break.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo. Joël est monté à Gonzalo Ponte, Gonzalo. Je veux voir chanter avec moi. Par où une guébrale est en plein, ça va passer dans la vie, moi. Pas danser, coller, à chanter. C'est mon vibe qui va me chercher. L'oublier tout ça qui est passé. L'aime danser, me sentir sous la.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, me, Nana Jumpy. We continue our exploration of the impacts of the attacks on Black voting power with Dr. Barbara Ramsby. Dr. Barbara Ramsby is the founding director of the Social Justice Initiative and the John D. MacArthur Chair and Distinguished Professor in the Departments of Black Studies and Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She is the author of the award-winning books, Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, A Radical Democratic Vision, and Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. She is also a longtime social justice activist and serves on the boards of several community organizations. Greetings, Barbara. Thank you so much, comrade, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Nana. Always a great pleasure to talk to you.
Wanting to look at this fight over Black voting power and, you know, most of what we've heard people do is talk about it from sort of the traditional perspective, which is very much rooted in got to get folks in government because the government will save you, you know, a lot of that, which clearly for folks that are on the left are not necessarily looking at this voting power as the way to liberation. But it still matters. Why, from the perspective of those of us on the left, does it still matter whether or not every state in the South, potentially 30 states out of the union, decide that Black votes don't count?
Right. Well, it's a good question. And, you know, often we frame the question in a way that doesn't get us to where we need to be. So let me just say, you know, people often say this thing of Black people fought and died for the right to vote, which is actually not quite true. Black people fought and died for the right to fight for their freedom, that, you know, to move the needle on freedom. So voting is a tool. It always has been a tool. It always has been augmented by other tactics and strategies You know, even when the Voting Rights Act was won, it was won not just by politicians or even voters, but by people marching in the streets, people willing to confront the police when necessary, organizing their neighbors and so forth. So in terms of where voting fits in the whole scheme of things, you know, it is one part, but an important part of a larger struggle that has many components. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is, you know, we help, what voting does is help to determine the terrain of struggle. People say simplistically, we vote to elect the person, you know, our next round of opponents. So, you know, that's true, but it also matters whether you have a fascist government or a bourgeois democratic government. If you understand the government that's claiming to be a democratic government is not democratic in the expansive, radical, inclusive way that we imagine democracy, right? But still, we have maneuverability under that kind of a regime that we don't have under a fascist regime, which puts us in defensive mode and survival mode. It is not to let the liberals off the hook, but it is to say we can do more under that context, under that form of rule and manipulation than we can under, you know, an outright oligarchy and an outright fascist regime. We don't have a full-fledged fascist regime now, but we're on our way to that. And that's why elections matter as one tool in our toolbox. And that's why we have to fight for those rights to be preserved. That's why they were opposed with such violence and vigor and determination by the other side, is because they do matter, you know. And you know, people talk about voting like I'm voting my conscience, or I'm voting for the person I believe in. I have rarely voted for a politician that I wholly believe in. I have voted in a very pragmatic way to ameliorate conditions of suffering, to give us a little breathing room in terms of organizing. And that is how we should view it. You know, it is not a ticket to liberation. It is a strategic decision to help determine the terrain of struggle. And that's kind of how I see it.
As you were talking, I was thinking about African martial arts. Okay. And I'm a practitioner of Capoeira Angola, at least I used to be when I was willing to get out there and roll around on the floor. Mm-hmm. And it's based on the Congolese principle, right? Old principle of defense offense, right? That you fight by defending and then attacking. It's the reason Muhammad Ali would point to his face and say, "My face still pretty," right? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm trying not to get hit. And then at the same time, I'm also engaging in an attack, right? I have an offense as well. And I think sometimes people are not clear that that's what we're engaging in, right? Where it's like, what do they say? Politics is warfare without, you know, bloodshed, so-called. Now we know that's not quite true, but you know, give me some license here, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of it. It's like, yeah, we're trying to defend ourselves as well as do some things on the offense. I mean, some things that I hear, and you know, I'm thinking about some of the folks, particularly the more radically, quote unquote, left side, like I've heard people literally say, well, bring on fascism because, you know, we've dealt with this before and we can deal with it again. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, not very generously, I must say. I mean, listen, you know, in my day, and I grew up in Detroit in the 1970s, there was a lot of talk of revolution. And I think we do need a revolution, but what kind of revolution do we need and how do we make it? Is the question. And so it is arrogant of us, it is contemptuous of us to say that reforms don't matter and small changes don't matter. It's people who are living on the edge. You know, you can say, you know, the ruling class is giving us crumbs when you win a labor dispute, right? Where you have a dollar more an hour or $2 more an hour. That might be the difference between, you know, having all the kids in the family eat or not. And so those small incremental changes matter. They do not liberate us. In some ways, it's a circular struggle. It's an uphill struggle. But those things matter. A little bit of protection and cushion against police violence matters. So those things matter. And it's a dialectic. It's a tension. It's a nuance between the incremental small reform changes and the big systemic change, which is what we ultimately need. So to say we would bring on fascism in order to expedite revolution, one is ahistorical, because if bringing on fascism would immediately lead to revolution, we would have had a bunch of revolutions that we did not have in places all over the world where fascism and dictatorships prevailed for many years. And the second thing is to reflect a certain kind of callousness toward the suffering that people experience. I know people who were tortured, you know, under dictatorships in Latin America. That's no joke. You know, you can't just say, well, we'll endure whatever they bring on and bring it on. Therefore, that suffering will somehow yield something. The somehow is a big somehow. And the suffering that occurs in the process is very, very real. So we always have to, you know, Che Guevara had that famous quote about revolutionaries are motivated by great feelings of love. You know, if we are not motivated by love of our people and wanting to ameliorate harm while we fight for a larger goal of social transformation, then I don't know what we're doing. So I have very little patience for people to say, bring on fascism. Either they don't know what fascism is and can do to us and people that we love and people we respect and admire, you know, or they're callous, you know, see this as some sort of performance, some sort of flex of radical masculinity or something like that, than actual transformation to have a more just and humane society, which ought to be our ultimate goal for Black people and for all people.
Absolutely. And thinking in terms of Black people and all people, I think there has been some reticence to really, until now, right, until Louisiana versus Calais, when people were just so obviously going after Black voting rights. But even with that, there's been some reticence about really talking about what is happening as an attack on Black power, mm-hmm. because I think people feel like, well, if we do that, then these other folks are not going to come up. You're not going to support it, right? Because once you make something a Black issue, then it becomes more difficult to get people who are not Black to be in the mix. Now, I think that, you know, when we look, for example, at policing and abolition, and when we look at what has happened around the invasion of the body snatchers, as we at Baji call these invasions by, in terms of ICE enforcement, and how people have responded, it's been a multiracial response. It hasn't just been Black folks, but somehow in this conversation of Black voting power, there is this, I think, a little bit of fear that it has to be talked about in a way that's around party politics or around, you know, politic, as opposed to really being about Black people and Black power. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. There's one, a shift in terms of a lot of liberal attitudes around race and backlash against DEI and diversity, and all of those reforms were not what those of us who had more radical vision for change in, you know, demanded in the first place. But the attack on them is a racist attack. The other thing is, we've had for a while among certain sectors of the white left this kind of colorblind approach, you know, that in introducing race into the mix, into the debate, into the discussion, into the demands, into the framing, actually divides us and compromises our ability to talk about affordability and class issues and the things that we all share. The point is, of course, we've not shared those experiences equally in many, many historical examples of that. So I think we're fighting against both the right-wing attack on the right-wing resurgence of, you know, blatant unapologetic racism. We think of some of the things, you know, Trump says and does, some of the things Pete Hegseth says and does. You know, this is old school racism, not new racism. There's that. And that is those people who think we need to be more like the center, whatever that means, more. We need to capture some of the MAGA voters who've been won to these racist ideas, which perhaps that can happen. But there are a lot of other people not in that category that need to be struggled with and won first. And some of those people are people who claim to be on the left, who argue that we need to not talk about race anymore. It's divisive. It's, you know, compromising our ability. So I think those are the things we have to challenge. And the other thing is, people fail to realize, you know, race and Black liberation and the Black freedom movement has never been an insular movement, right? when they come for us, they're eventually going to come for others. And that has been systemically the case, historically the case. Conversely, when Black people moved the needle on freedom, for example, in Reconstruction, in the first Reconstruction and the second Reconstruction, poor and working class white people benefit. We win social reforms and protections that other people benefit from too. You know, the white women, other racialized groups, minority groups, that's not my language, but that's the legal language, and disabled people, a whole number of protected groups have benefited from the forward leadership of Black people during the Black Freedom Movement. So inextricably linked to a larger project of transformative democracy is the fight around racism. And the more that is abandoned and pushed under the rug, the weaker any kind of left movement is going to be.
I want to ask some about this, the worker piece, the working class folks, impoverished folks piece. But before I get to that, as you were talking, I was thinking about a theory that I have that you reminded me of, that, you know, there is this effort to make people undocumented as to certain rights, right? And that effort starts and focuses, when we're looking in the space of electoral power, voting power, with Black people. So it's like the voter ID requirements and this requirement, all these different requirements are like this effort to make sure that Black people don't have the paperwork and the things they need to have in order to be able to vote. And then you get to a SAVE Act, and then all these women, many of whom are not Black, suddenly realize, wait, for the purposes of voting, I'm going to end up in some undocumented space, you know? And so the ways in which attacks that are seen as just on Black folks, with the respect, for example, to voting and voter ID, suddenly you look up and there's all these other people that have been swept up into that mix.
Exactly. And also swept up into the increasing surveillance state, you know? So the surveillance of non-citizens, the surveillance of our immigrant family becomes also surveillance of everybody, you know, surveillance of everybody vulnerable, to everybody who's a dissenter, to everybody who doesn't have proper documentation validating their right to be here, speak out, vote, move from place A to place B, et cetera. I mean, there's an increasing surveillance culture, which is a characteristic of fascism, and groups get targeted and then it expands to a larger section of the population. That is how it's happened historically. I mean, people talk about Nazi Germany, and of course, you know, millions of Jews were the focus of the Nazi crusades, but there were also gay people, women, Jehovah's Witnesses, Roma people. I mean, a whole number of people got swept up in the Nazi madness and terror, you know, in addition to the group that it was most targeted.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that. And like just the past couple of weeks with the and more, a little further back, but at least the past couple of weeks with them demanding the voting rolls. We want the voting rolls, right?
Yeah.
Because we're allegedly looking for people who are voting who are not supposed to be voting. And that's everybody's voting record. That's not just the voting record of the people that they allegedly are looking for.
Exactly. And the other thing I want to say about the voting piece, Nana, kind of as a historian, you know, every moment of electoral action and electoral intervention is not the same. So in this moment, I feel, you know, much of my own political career has not been focused on electoral work. It's not focused on electoral work now, but I think it's really critical in this period. Partly because there is a new group of young, progressive, and some radical politicians and folks running for office and leading referenda campaigns and ballot initiatives all across the country, you know, who are not in the pocket of the corporate Democrats, who are not towing the line of, you know, Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, who are, you know, defying incumbents who have been do nothing incumbents, you know, taking money from AIPAC and others, you know. So we see a different type of person entering the electoral arena, which changes the games. I have a lot of confidence in Rashida Tlaib and Corey Bush, who's running again, who was pushed out because of her progressive politics, Justin Pearson in Tennessee, young brother who's in Memphis. They gerrymandered his district, and he's fighting to win this new gerrymandered district, but also fighting to build a movement in Tennessee. So I think those factors, those developments in terms of shifts and changes in the electoral landscape and ecosystem are actually really important in terms of what can be leveraged in that arena. And again, that is not all we need to do, but it is one thing we have to do. It is indispensable and inadequate. So, and I think keeping those two things in mind are really important. We can't write it off, but we can't say job is done once we've cast a ballot.
I love that. I'm marking that on the wall. Indispensable and yeah, inadequate. I love that. Yeah, that describes that tension. Mm-hmm. Thinking about, I mean, with a lot of the elected, those young progressives and others that are coming into office, that are running now on local levels all the way to federal levels, you hear a lot of more conversation about working class folks and even, dare I say, impoverished people. A lot more conversation than we have in the past. It's always been, or not always, but for many years now, it's been a focus on middle class and focus on sort of the bourgeoisie class. And you're hearing more conversations in that way. How do Black voting rights connect to the aspirations, you know, the needs, the challenges of working class people? How does the ability for Black people to exercise voting power relate to how we can address some of the issues and concerns of folks who are working class as well as impoverished people, regardless of race, whether they're Black or not?
Right. Well, you know, part of the issue I was, point I was trying to make before about Reconstruction, the first and the second, is when Black people have won reforms, it's always been about fighting racial, you know, overt racial violence and terror and intimidation. But it's also been about economic justice. And so when Black people have won economic gains, white people have had residual benefits, right? The ability to organize in unions was thwarted by the divisions between Black and white labor. And when Black people were excluded from unions, that hurt white workers too, even though they thought it made them more important or whatever. They still were, you know, being paid a pittance. When Black workers joined the labor movement, the strength of the overall working class, even though racism was still very real, increased. And so that's something that's, you know, important historically to keep in mind. But I think the overall response to that question is that the Black freedom movement has always been, from the times of enslavement to this very moment, both a racial struggle and an economic struggle, not one or the other, not this one first and that one second. It has always been both. And there is no way to define freedom and liberation for Black people without talking about class issues. And, you know, I forget who it was, but one of the Panthers, I think, said, you know, Black people weren't brought here as slaves, weren't brought here as Negroes, we were brought here as slaves, which is a form of labor, you know, of controlled labor and exploited, super exploited labor, where your whole body is owned for the purpose of someone else making a profit. So, you know, talk about embeddedness in a working class. We had no other option and no other recognition other than being a tool of elites for class exploitation. And racism and white supremacy was used to ensure that. So the intimate bond between race and class in terms of Black people's experience in this country is, you know, just so clear if we kind of look at the history and the phases of it. I think there's a way, though, in which talking about class and not factoring in the racial realities of the class history in this country is a dead end and is very problematic. We can't talk about the formation of a working class. There was never a working class in this country. The working class was formed at a time when Black people Black workers were enslaved. And so it was a formation of a white working class. And a number of my, you know, colleagues, David Rediger and Noam Ignatieff and others have written about this. But it was a formation of a white working class. And workers, white workers, were basically given some solace in the fact that they weren't Black slaves. They weren't Black enslaved people. So the whole consciousness of a working class and its origins in this country, you know, is steeped in race and white supremacy. So all of those factors have to fold into our understanding of this contemporary moment where absolutely we need multiracial unity. Absolutely we need class struggle. And absolutely the fight for racial justice and against white supremacy has to be critical to both of those. And if we don't understand that, we are, I don't know where we're headed.
But we know it ain't nowhere good.
That's true.
How do folks reach you? How do folks or reach your work? Get more information about what you're doing. Keep up with what you're doing. It's certainly well worth their time.
Well, you know, I have not been on, I think I'm going to go back on social media. And a number of people ask me lately, you know, I've been doing a lot of things in this period, but I've seen a lot of things on social media that just were not helpful. And I said, I'm not going to be active again until I have something to say. I am working on a new book project. And so I'm hoping that will have some useful offering to the movement. Talked to a lot of people and been thinking and, you know, sitting with it and crying about it and yelling about it for, you know, a few years now. So hopefully that will be in the mix pretty soon. But, you know, I'm you know, I have a Blue Sky account and I still have a Twitter account, although I don't use it. I'm on Facebook. I will return to Facebook very soon. And people can reach me, you know, barbara.ransby@gmail.com.
Thank you so very much. Really, really appreciate you. Barbara, thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you, Nana. And you know, I appreciate your leadership, your resilience, your joyfulness amid struggle. And I think that is the spirit that will carry us. So thank you for all that you do.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. And that was historian, author, activist, and professor, Dr. Barbara Ransby, on Black Voting Power, the Left, and Fighting Fascism. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including our dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Coltrane, and producer, Gary Scott, and you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum returns this June 6th through October 4th with outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside Romeo and Juliet, Treasure Island, Noel Coward's Waiting in the Wings, and Bernardo Cubría's dark and incisive new comedy, The People of Pompeii, set in the aftermath of the 2025 Palisades fire. Theatricum is located in Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway, in the shade of the California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.theatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
Low. Low is a sacred word. Low is the name of God. The entire universe is created with love, by love, and in love. Love is the beginning. Love is the continuation. Love is the end.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
That love supreme reign over the universe. Om Shanti.
Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent Pacifica Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM. People have the power.